From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The White House review of Afghanistan. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Having sent 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, President Obama conceded today that progress is fragile. He still thinks withdrawal can begin next July, but he also said the war is moving into what he called a new phase, and U.S. combat forces will remain till December of 2014. Intelligence estimates say the fight will be harder than the Pentagon claims, with Pakistan refusing to shut down Taliban sanctuaries across the border. A new poll shows that 60% of Americans don't think the war is worth fighting. We'll hear how the president defines his goals as well as his strategy. On Reporter's Notebook, new trouble for BP. Here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. New from WikiLeaks, BP had to conduct a mass evacuation after a gas leak in Azerbaijan 18 months before the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. This as the Obama Justice Department files a lawsuit that could cost the company tens of billions of dollars. We'll hear that more about that later on our program. First, this news update. With Secretaries Clinton and Gates at his side, President Obama said today that gains in Afghanistan are fragile but real, and he still hopes to begin a so-called conditions-based withdrawal in July of next year.
We are moving toward a new phase in Afghanistan, a transition to full Afghan lead for security that will begin early next year and will conclude in 2014.
Again, the president speaking today at the White House. Julian Barnes is Pentagon reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Julian, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
New phase, concluding with the combat in 2014. Is that a big change from past policy?
Well, you know, this review didn't get into the real details of what this mission is going to look like later this year. That transition point the president was talking about begins in July when the drawdown starts. Now, at the press conference today, Mr. Gates was asked how fast that drawdown was going to be. He declined to answer. So we don't know exactly what that transition period is going to look like.
So the much-awaited review then at the White House really hasn't told us much new, except that there's a lot of uncertainty.
I think that's right. I mean, this review didn't tackle those critical questions of how fast the drawdown is going to be, how much the mission changes, is there a shift from counterinsurgency to counterterror later this summer, next summer. And that was partially because the military wants to have some more time to show some, prove out their strategy on the ground.
On the other hand, the president says new phase. So what does he mean?
Well, I think that there is no doubt. I mean, there's no doubt that this drawdown begins in July. And the president, I think, by saying that is, putting everyone on notice that he is going to be expecting the Afghans to take an increasingly active role in securing the country. Now, this report, in some of the parts that have not yet been made public and may never be made public, really raises some questions about the ability of the Afghan security forces to operate independently. And that's going to be something the White House, the Pentagon, all of the U.S. government is going to be looking at.
Everybody agrees, of course, that what is necessary is further training of the Afghan forces. What did the president have to say about that today?
Well, he had, he mentioned, and the report mentions, that there's been a lot of improvement in that. They've really dramatically raised marksmanship. They've really dramatically expanded the number of people they've trained. But when you get behind that language, the issue there is those are the inputs. You know, what goes into the training has improved. The level of training has improved. The number of people they're training has improved. What they don't know yet is how does that play out on the ground? Does that mean these guys can do plan operations on their own? So far, not that much. Are they going to be able to secure large swaths of Afghanistan without any U.S. help? We don't know that yet.
The first thing that Hillary Clinton said was, after she made reference to the late Richard Holbrooke, was that we inherited, as she put it, no strategy, no mission, military and civilian forces lacking resources to get needed progress accomplished. Are they still trying to blame the Bush administration, even though the president is the one who recently, in December at least, a year ago, escalated the forces?
You know, it was very. That struck me as well when she saw that, and the fact that she really emphasized, you know, that they felt they had inherited a war in disarray. I mean, this is very much Obama's war at this point. He has approved two increases. He's appointed two generals to oversee that war. He has had a lot of time to shape it. It's a little weird to. Blame the to push it off on the previous administration. That said, you know, even military people will say time and time again that this war was under-resourced for 7-8 years, and that it is only in the last year that the full attention of the government, the full resources that the war needs, are on the ground. And so, therefore, you need to give the strategy some time to work. And so maybe that's what she was getting at.
We heard the president very briefly a moment ago. We'll hear more from him as our program goes forward. But how would you describe his demeanor, his attitude, his level of energy today?
Well, you know, it is interesting. I, as a Pentagon reporter, don't see the president up close and personal that often. He did seem very focused. He was taking this opportunity to reiterate, I thought, that he saw this strategy as an al-Qaeda focus, not a Taliban-focused strategy, not a government of Afghanistan-focused strategy, but something that was focused on, al-Qaeda, which he talks about a lot, the military talks about less. He seemed pretty engaged and pretty direct on this. He did not take questions himself, though, so there was not a chance to really try to engage him.
Again, we're talking with Julian Barnes with the Wall Street Journal Pentagon reporter. In a moment, we'll have more on the White House review of strategy in Afghanistan on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, still talking about the White House review of the war in Afghanistan. The president said today the U.S. will be relentless, that's his word, in achieving its goals in Afghanistan. So what, once again, are those goals?
From the start, I've been very clear about our core goal. It's not to defeat every last threat to the security of Afghanistan, because ultimately it is Afghans who must secure their country. And it's not nation building, because it is Afghans who must build their nation. Rather, we are focused on disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's no more al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, is there, Julian Barnes?
Not really. There may be, at any given time, there may be a stray dozen or so al-Qaeda fighters. It is not a large number. They do remain in Pakistan. They're not in Afghanistan.
So that's really then the focus, even though the president doesn't quite say that.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit upon an interesting thing. The logic of the White House is to prevent al-Qaeda from coming back into Afghanistan, we must prevent the Taliban from retaking power. And therefore, what we're doing in Afghanistan is focused on al-Qaeda. But it is interesting. The president always talks about al-Qaeda. He does not talk about the Taliban. The military almost always talks about the Taliban.
Okay. Again, Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, as always, for being with us.
Thank you.
While the Pentagon has emphasized progress since the president escalated the war last December, America's combined intelligence agencies tell a different story, emphasizing especially the failure of Pakistan to shut down Taliban sanctuaries across the Afghan border. Here again, President Obama.
We've welcomed major Pakistani offensives in the tribal regions. We will continue to help strengthen Pakistan's capacity to root out terrorists. Nevertheless, progress has not come fast enough. So we will continue to insist to Pakistani leaders that terrorist safe havens within their borders must be dealt with.
Carolyn Wadhams is with the Liberal Center for American Progress. She is the lead author of a report called Realignment, Managing a Stable Transition to Afghan Responsibility. Carolyn Wadhams, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit more, if you will, about what the combined intelligence agencies have reported, because it's a good deal less optimistic than what the White House Review had to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main points coming out of that those leaked intelligence assessments, although I haven't been able to see a classified the classified document, but news reports indicate that what they're pointing to is really the continued sanctuaries for Afghan insurgents within Pakistan, and that until we can effectively deal with those sanctuaries, then it will be very difficult to defeat this insurgency in Afghanistan. That was I think one of the primary points. Another thing that it pointed to was just about the fragility of the gains made against the Taliban. And concerns about the insurgency actually spreading throughout the country.
The president himself said that the progress was frail. You just said the fragility of the gains. So does he appear to have picked up at least part of what the intelligence agencies had to say?
I think that this assessment, the president's assessment, definitely has some of it. It raises some of the same concerns as the intelligence agencies. This document, the review has a little bit more of a positive spin, but a lot of the challenges are acknowledged in both documents, just in terms of Pakistan and in terms of, you know, the review talks a lot about some of the progress that's been made, but there, if you look at the document, they're always qualified. It's a limited progress. It's potentially reversible. It's fragile. So there are a lot of qualifications even for the claims they're making about progress.
To what extent is the Obama White House itself divided about what ought to be done with regard to Afghanistan?
I think they're actually quite divided, and a lot of the debates that we saw in the review months ago, over a year ago, and then which were revealed again in the Bob Woodward book, I don't think a lot of those issues have been resolved. And you hear, even talking to people within the administration, that there is disagreement, I think, among people within the Department of Defense and within the U.S. military, and the White House, State Department, USAID, who have different assessments of how well the U.S. strategy is actually working. There are, I think, major concerns from what I've heard in the White House about just about the sustainability of these gains, and which are acknowledged in this assessment.
Again, Caroline Williams is with the Center for American Progress. Stephen Biddle is Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. He's a former associate professor at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Stephen Biddle, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What would you say about victory and defeat in the Afghanistan situation? When the president lays out his goal, does it sound like what most Americans think of as victory?
Well, I think Americans tend to have a binary view of victory and defeat. Victory is, you know, ticker tape parades and signing ceremonies on battleship decks. You know, defeat is the opposite. Most wars don't end that way, though. World War II is in some ways an anomaly. By and large, wars end in negotiated settlements of some kind. They can be settlements that favor one side substantially relative to the other, but there's usually some kind of negotiation that produces a deal. That will almost certainly be the case here as well. What the war is really about between now and then is over what will the terms of the settlement be. But when we continue to use even terms like success and failure, which is a much weaker formulation than victory and defeat, we still tend to think in terms of destroying the enemy or somehow evicting them from the theater operations. And I doubt that's what's going to happen here, and I think the strategy is oriented towards producing a kind of a settlement we can live with rather than some annihilation of the Taliban.
Caroline Wadhams, back to you. Once again, Secretary Clinton and the president himself made reference to the late Richard Holbrook, who was the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Did his role and the difficulty he appeared to have in playing it reflect some ambiguity, if that's the right term, with regard to American strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you saw that with Ambassador Holbrooke that, you know, it was never clear what exactly his role was and what he was actually in charge of within the portfolio. There's been, I think, more confusion on the civilian side about who's actually in charge of that strategy, despite the fact that it's probably the most important element of the strategy. And you've seen, I think, just how dominant the U.S. military and General Petraeus himself has been within, you know, as being the sort of the more of the public face of this strategy. Ambassador Holbrooke, I think, went into that job expecting that he would have much more control over resources and ability to appoint people and to really drive the strategy. And I think because of sort of the marginalization of civilians generally within this strategy and probably confusion over what the actual end game is, he was, I think, given a less prominent role.
Stephen Biddle, the president said today that the goal is not nation building. What about the civilian aspect of this? How important is it, and what is it doing?
Well, all the way back to the infamous McChrystal assessment report, the military in particular has said that co-equally necessary for success is governance reform, not just improvement on the ground in security. There's a tendency to assume that when people say you need governance reform, that that's the civilian side of things. That's their job. I think actually the reason why the McChrystal military assessment included governance reform as being so central is because it's as much a military job as it is a civilian job. I mean, it's important that we get more civilian advisors into the country to help with economic development, to assist Afghans in improving the technical parts of running the government. But at least as important to getting improvement in governance is having the military campaign be run in a way that doesn't contribute to the problem of malign, predatory governance in Afghanistan that in many ways is really the central challenge to governance success. The civilian surge notion tends to imply that the problem with governance in Afghanistan is they don't have enough trained civilian administrators, they don't have enough people who can run agricultural extension operations and so on. And therefore sending more American civilians to Afghanistan is the way to make things better. I actually think the real problem with governance in Afghanistan is not that a government that theoretically wants the right thing just doesn't have enough wherewithal and resources to do it right. I think the real problem with governance in Afghanistan is that too much of the Afghan government wants the wrong thing. They're engaged in actively preying upon the population they're supposed to be governing. To fix that problem requires a much broader change in the way we do business than just parachuting into Afghanistan another 1,000 or another 2,000 civilian experts in various technical aspects of life in Afghanistan.
Stephen Biddle again with the Council on Foreign Relations. Caroline Wadhams, back to you with the Center for American Progress, a liberal organization, presumably somewhat supportive of the president. But do you feel he's dropped the ball in terms of Afghanistan in the way that Stephen Biddle suggests perhaps he has?
Yeah, I think there are major problems that exist in this strategy. I mean, first of all, there's a problem with the Obama administration still hasn't figured out what our end state is in Afghanistan. They have not been able to effectively link how the overarching goal of defeating al-Qaeda, preventing its return from Afghanistan, how you link up what we're doing in Afghanistan to that bigger goal. What is good enough so that you can prevent al-Qaeda from returning to Afghanistan if that's the overall objective? You know, I thought it was really interesting today in the press briefing, Secretary of Defense Gates said at one point, you know, we've got to keep our objectives have to be minimal. We can't do it all in Afghanistan. Then he went on to say that, you know, in order to have stability, we need to be able to create security, dispute resolution, and have health clinics within an hour of walking distance, in every district in Afghanistan. I mean, there is such confusion about what we're trying to achieve. And I think, you know, there has been some limited progress within specific areas of Afghanistan, especially in Kandahar and Helmand. But the issue is whether that actually gets you closer to the end state, which is not clear at this point. I mean, how does if the goal is to you know, be able to get out of Afghanistan without it falling into civil war and having it be a vacuum, we're not getting, there's no progress in any of those fundamental issues which are related to governance, political exclusion, and the safe haven in Pakistan. We're not getting any closer to achieving those objectives.
Stephen Biddle, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with much of it, but not all of it. I think the administration does need to be clearer, both with the public, but also internally, on what our war aims are. I mean, what political outcome in Afghanistan can we live with and are willing to fight to produce? What outcomes can we not live with? With respect to whether progress is being made on the governance front, though, I think progress is being made, but it's slow and it's hard to observe, in part because there's a change in conceptualization going on in Afghanistan about what the governance problem is. For a long, long time in Afghanistan, and in our doctrine for counterinsurgency generally, we tended to look at governance the way I described earlier. It's a problem of building up the capacity of a putatively benign host government. I think we've increasingly come to recognize that that's not the problem in Afghanistan and have been shifting to a conception of what we need to do about governance in the country that's oriented towards disempowering networks of malign actors within the government who are currently empowered, importantly, by contract money that we are spending in the country that they redirect, skim, and put to the purposes of the construction of patronage networks that enable them to then turn and prey on the population they're nominally going to serve. As we've shifted focus, it's set up a new set of requirements for things we have to do that we had not been doing. Especially, we have to redirect our own intelligence services to understanding how our money is being misused, who the key bad actors are, what companies and what contracts are being used to redirect funds. Once we know that, we can then start to cancel contracts, change the way we spend money and do business, and start the process of weakening these networks. It's interesting that we recently, for example, blacklisted Watan Risk Management, which is one of the more prominent of the corporate entities in southern Afghanistan that have been used to redirect American money to the operation of a predatory government network in Kandahar province. That's suggestive that we're doing some of this homework and we're starting to make some changes and we're starting to have some traction. It's harder to observe than changes in security. It's harder to publicize than the ability to walk through Argandab or Panjwa outside Kandahar, whereas you couldn't do that a year ago. It is progress, though. It is important, but it's fairly early in the process of this kind of redesign of the governance campaign.
Stephen Biddle again with the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll come back and talk further about the White House report today and the consequences for the war in Afghanistan. On Reporter's Notebook, more trouble for BP, not just in the U.S., but in Azerbaijan as well. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. As the president was discussing the review of strategy in Afghanistan today, the Washington Post published a new survey showing that a record 60% of Americans don't think America's longest war has been worth fighting. Today, the president reflected on the sacrifices that U.S. troops are making, and he called for civilian support.
We're going to have to continue to stand up. We'll continue to give our brave troops and civilians the strategy and resources they need to succeed. We will never waver from our goal of disrupting, dismantling, and ultimately defeating al-Qaeda. We will forge enduring partnerships with people who are committed to progress and to peace. And we will continue to do everything in our power to ensure the security and the safety of the American people.
David Korn is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, a liberal organization. He's also a columnist at PoliticsDaily.com. And, David, it's always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Of course, all Americans are in favor of the troops that are sent into harm's way. But what about support for the war itself? Seven years, is it, since it began? And what do you think that what the president said today and the information that came from the review is going to lead particularly the Democratic base to be any more supportive than it has been?
I don't think anything today will change the politics facing the president on this very challenging issue of the Afghanistan war. You know, looking at the polls over the course of the last few years, it's roughly half the country is opposed to the war. Sometimes the number is higher, sometimes it's lower, and half the country say they support it. But more importantly, I think most of the country is disengaged on the war. If you watch a lot of media, as I know I do, you don't see a lot of references to the war. It's not on a lot of front pages of local newspapers. The Times and the Post, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, major newspapers still try to cover it. But even in those pages, you can sometimes go a week or two without seeing a major story on what's happening with the war. So the polls, I think, reflect the fact that people would rather not even think about this. And the president has a tough time. Today, I mean, Caroline, who was just on, got this exactly right. I was in the press room at the time, and this was like the one quote that jumped out at me. Almost everything there you could have scripted was when Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said that our objectives in Afghanistan are minimalist. Now, it isn't that this hasn't been said before, and he's not referring to an art style, but it's take a step back and say the president says we have to be in Afghanistan to protect ourselves for our national security sake, and yet our objectives are minimalist. Those are two notions that are a bit at war with each other. You know, usually, as one of your earlier speakers said, we used to think of wars as gigantic, affairs in which there's a clear victory and a clear endpoint. Here we have minimalist objectives, which may actually, as Caroline also noted, may not be all that minimalist, and that aren't well defined. The public certainly, is lost, I would say, by this point in the conversation. They haven't followed it far enough to know what those objectives are, so they have no idea how to judge it, or in a lot of ways, I think, what to think about it. Now, this may work to Barack Obama's advantage. He's going to be up for an election, and the war won't be over. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction, as you mentioned earlier, amongst the Democratic base about this war. I think, we see anger over deals like the tax cut compromise the past week. And I think this is sort of a steady, sort of low volume, which is weird when you think about it, we're talking about a war, but sort of low volume background noise to Democratic dissatisfaction with Barack Obama. And I don't know anything he says today, anything he's going to do in July 2011 is going to change that picture much.
David Corin, Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. Harlan Ullman is a senior advisor to the Atlantic Council. That's a nonpartisan think tank that focuses on transatlantic issues. He's a distinguished senior fellow at the National Defense University, and he served in past as an advisor to both John McCain and John Kerry. Harlan Ullman, good to have you on our program.
Happy holidays, Warren.
Same to you. What about the politics of this? And if the Democratic base is disaffected, if American people in general are disengaged, where are the Republicans?
I wouldn't say that they're disengaged. They are on a pretty strong wicket because they're going to support President Obama, who would be against the war, who would be against our fighting men and women. And I think what you have to realize, way back in the early winter of 2009 when Obama entered office, his view of Afghanistan was cut and run. And that was not going to be practical. And I think it transformed itself into cut and walk. I know he was not happy with the review that took place and being forced, in essence, by the Department of Defense to have this surge. And I think now the NATO summit in Lisbon, which is set 2014 as a deadline date for NATO to be out and Afghanistan to be in fully, gives the president something of a bit of relief. But my guess is over the summer, Obama is going to start some kind of withdrawal because 2012 is going to be a fixation and obsession with everybody in Washington. And I think the Republicans will have a slight advantage because foreign policy outside a crisis or a catastrophe really doesn't weigh very heavily in our presidential elections usually, are going to say, look, we supported you in Afghanistan. Now you're cutting and walking and cutting and running, and they will use that against him. And in many ways, they will make common cause with some of the dissident Democrats. Having said that, and my own view about Afghanistan is entirely negative, because I think what your other speakers have said lays out some of the contradictions. The biggest failing is Pakistan. That unless we get Pakistan right, which we will not, in my judgment, unless we do things differently, there is virtually no chance of being able to succeed, however you define it, in Afghanistan. But this time next year, everybody's going to be obsessed with foreign with jobs, employment, and the election. And I'm afraid that Afghanistan, Pakistan, and indeed Iraq, which is really off everybody's radar screen, will really be falling into something that people are not going to be fully able to take on until after the elections, I'm afraid.
Harlan Ullman with the Atlantic Council. Still with us, Stephen Biddle with the Council on Foreign Relations. Do you agree that the president's initial feeling was a cut and run, and that he's now changed it to cut and walk?
No. This president has tripled our troop count in Afghanistan. He campaigned on the idea that we would draw down in Iraq in order to increase our efforts in Afghanistan. Now, one can debate what the president's particular plan or expectation or willingness over a long period of time to sustain a high level of engagement would be. I think to some extent all those things are actually moving targets. But the idea that this president came in with the conception of cutting and running, cutting and walking, or cutting in anything in Afghanistan is, I think, radically at odds with the actual record of what the man said during the campaign. So I think one can debate what the appropriate way forward is. One can debate whether how much sacrifice over time the president is willing to make, but I think it's a substantial misinterpretation of the man's platform to believe that he wanted to disengage in Afghanistan.
David Korn, back to you. You use the term disengage to describe the American people. How long is that going to last, though, even if the economy is the main issue in the campaign, when we're spending $1 billion a year and people are dying?
You know, that's a really good question. I will admit that I have predicted wrongly over the course of the last couple of years that Afghanistan would become a political conflict. Not just a military conflict, and I mean a political conflict back here at home. But, you know, you have increasing dissatisfaction among House Democrats in Congress. You know, up to now, they haven't been willing to make too much of a stink about it, partly because with the number of Democrats who support the president and the Republican Party more or less supporting him on this point, it's not a winning battle for Democratic critics. So giving the president somewhat of the benefit of the doubt, they have been reluctant to make this a fight the way they, you know, did with, say, Iraq and President Bush. So they're not leading the way there. The American public, you know, is indeed more concerned, I presume, with jobs and the economy. I mean, yesterday, I believe, in the Daily Beast, Leslie Gelb, who used to be the president of the Council of Foreign Relations, had a column saying it's just ridiculous for us to be spending $125 billion a year in Afghanistan, where we should be using that money here at home to help people who are hard-pressed and to build our own schools and improve our own infrastructure, which is crumbling. And I think it's a marvelous talking point. I personally agree with it, but it's one that hasn't gotten much political traction yet. And I don't know if that's going to come to pass. And you know, you mentioned earlier this war has been going on for 7 years, but actually it's nine years.
Yeah, so I made a mistake.
That's just, you know, I'm not criticizing you, but we've had 9 years without this war generating much political debate, which is quite astounding, I think.
Once again, Hillary Clinton said today that they inherited no strategy, no mission, inadequate forces, lacked the resources, and so on. Harlan Ullman, you said that it was the Defense Department that forced the surge. Are there those, including yourself perhaps, who think we need more troops rather than less?
On the contrary, look, history counts in a sense to show the contradictions and the problems that Mr. Obama has put himself in. This administration is more about campaigning for issues than it is about governing. During the campaign, Obama was advised by a lot of people not to run against John McCain by saying Afghanistan is where we have to focus. We were wrong in Iraq because it was going to become his war. He entered office, and the first thing he had to do was agree to the transfer of some 15,000 troops, because if he didn't, it would have taken an additional 8 or 9 months for them to get there. So he was backed into that. People, for example, such as the vice president, strongly opposed any kind of buildup. And during the summer of 2009, General Jones was then the National Security Advisor, went to Afghanistan, saw General McChrystal, and asked that famous question that I will put in more proper English, what the hell are you guys doing? So I don't think that Obama was really somebody who was as aggressive in dealing with it, because of campaigns, because of slogans, and because his administration in the White House was really, really very inexperienced and not used to dealing with some of the heavy hitters. We kind of slid our way in. Now the question is, how do we slide our way out? And I think that the only way that we do that is to empower Afghanistan, as we're trying to do, to turn over security matters to them. A former finance minister named Ashraf Ghani has gone back to Afghanistan, where he's now in charge of the transfer program. He's a very able guy, and I think that there will be some very, very good projects and strategies coming out early in the new year. But we also have to focus on Pakistan, where, quite frankly, when you compare what's gone to Pakistan in terms of aid and military support, it has been peanuts compared to the trillions of dollars or hundreds of billions of dollars we've poured into Iraq and into Afghanistan. And while the administration says that we cannot succeed without Pakistan, all they have provided is lip service. And quite frankly, the current Pakistani People's Party that's in control of parliament is on a very, very, very tough slide. And by the fall, you could see another party in power that would not be well disposed to our interests. So if we are serious about Afghanistan, we need to put more focus and more support on Pakistan.
Back to Caroline Wadham, still with us from the Center of for American Progress. Do you think the president wants to get out of Afghanistan as soon as possible, whether you call it cut and run or cut and walk?
Yeah, I mean, there are different indications, but it does appear that he wants to start getting out. That he, in July 2011, that there will be some kind of reduction. I mean, you get the sense, the way that he talks about it, constantly going back to that overall objective of Al-Qaeda, not in trying to consistently lower the expectations around the strategy, whether or not the strategy is actually minimal or not. I mean, the way that he talks about it, it seems like he wants to extract the United States out of this war. It's been difficult to know, because it's been so vague. And even with the transition, the talk of getting out by 2014, where we hand over security to the Afghans, none of that has been clearly outlined. And there's still discussion of conditions based on. But generally, I think the president wants to get the country out.
Stephen Biddle, back to you. With all that we've heard, as we did today on our program about the intelligence reports, is the idea of progress really pretty much a spin?
I'm sorry, the idea of progress is...
Is it a spin? I mean, is it reality, or can you really make a case for it?
Well, I think that the basic facts on the ground at the moment are agreed by just about everybody, including the intelligence reports, the command on the ground, and the White House. The areas where we've put troops are substantially more secure now than they were before. Where people are disagreeing is what inferences they draw from that for the future. Now, the problem in drawing inferences from that for the future is a lot of these clearance operations occurred only a couple of months ago, and we're now in the middle of the winter, which in Afghanistan is typically not an active military season. Warfare in Afghanistan tends to be cyclical and seasonal. There will almost certainly be Taliban counterattacks in all of the places where we have done clearance operations over the course of this past fighting season, beginning in the spring. So anything we can do about projecting forward right now is making guesses as to how the outcome of an inevitable counterattack is going to work itself out. Now, given that, I think the way that both the command and the administration have been articulating all this in the review is things look good on the basis of what we can observe so far, but it's too early to know how it's going to come out, and what has happened to this fighting season is fragile. I think what that means in concrete terms on the ground is they're expecting counterattacks in the spring. And until those counterattacks run their course and we know whether or not they succeed in retaking any of the ground that they lost this last summer, it's very hard to make determinate predictions for where the war is going to go in the medium term. Now, I tend to see that less as a matter of spin than as a matter of trying to deal with what is, at the end of the day, inherently ambiguous military futures in the country as we go into a winter in which not very much fighting is going to take place, and when we know that in the spring we're going to see more of it, and people are trying to guess in advance how that spring fighting season is going to work out. I don't know how you could come up with a determinate statement of any kind about the war right now, given the seasonal nature of the fighting and how recently the key clearance operations took place.
Caroline Wadhams, back to you. To what extent does all of this confusion, and even dating back to the Bush administration, reveal how little America knows about Afghanistan and how to what extent we failed to learn the lessons of Britain and Russia?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very true. I mean, I think we've learned a lot over the past 10 years about how governance works in Afghanistan and all the different ethnic groups and how the culture is, but there's been a steep learning curve, and I still think that we're not very good at being able to navigate this landscape, this very complicated landscape, and that's why it's so incredibly difficult. I mean, when you think about how the insurgency in Afghanistan has been able to expand, and now you see that they're getting into pockets in the north of Afghanistan, specifically Kunduz and Baghlan, they have waged a very effective campaign. It's both a political campaign, it's a violent campaign. They use both intimidation and violence, but they also know their landscape, and they can go into communities, and they have a sense of they have local knowledge of what's going on in those communities, who feels like they've lost out by the status quo, by the current power structure, and they can reach out, bring those people into their insurgency. So they have a much more sophisticated sense of their environment. And the challenge is for us is we're never going to be able to do that as well as they can. But we have to figure out how to mobilize all of the people in Afghanistan who are against the Taliban, the majority of whom are. They have to see it as their fight and be much stronger at being able to go toe-to-toe with the Taliban. We haven't been able to tap into that. A lot of Afghans still see this as a fight between us and the insurgency rather than taking it on as their own.
Quickly, Harlan Ullman, if we are dealing with a predatory a government in Afghanistan, one has to be reminded of how when the effort was made to crack down on President Karzai, it didn't work very well. Can we really deal with that? Do we know enough about Afghanistan to cope with it?
The answer is probably not. It's not just the predatory. It's incompetent and corrupt, which in some ways makes it even more difficult to deal with. Unless we can work at the local levels and extend governance there, we're going to have huge problems. And Carolyn was absolutely right. Our understanding of the tribal nature, we really don't know what a Taliban is. It's an old expression saying that all Taliban are Pashtun, but not all Pashtun are Taliban. The tribal and the local relationships, we talk about the cross-border with Pakistan. There are intermarried families in the Northwest Territory, formerly Northwest Territories in Fatah, who are sometimes Taliban, sometimes not. The Pakistanis tend to understand this better than we do, but unless or until Karzai and the government in the provinces are able to extend some form of governance and fairness, remember the Taliban were largely in place because of the need for some kind of justice, we're going to be on a fool's errand. And as I said before, unless we can really get Pakistan into this fight, and we may not be able to do it, I am very, very pessimistic about the outcome, even though Stephen Biddle is correct. At this stage, we don't know how the fighting is going to go on the ground in the spring, but we're looking at this in a broader political and strategic context, and in that regard, I am very negative.
So, David Korn, just a few seconds left, but more confusion, it seems to me, in the future for the American public.
Well, I think so. I mean, Afghanistan is a marvelously complicated subject. People who know the history, know foreign policy, can come up with completely different ideas about what should happen and where we should go. And most politicians who are engaging, or you'd expect to engage in a debate over this, aren't well-versed and well-schooled in these nuances. So I think, again, that may be to the president's advantage because it may give him a little more running room because there's people know less about it.
David Korn with Mother Jones Magazine, Harlan Ullman with the Atlantic Council, Stephen Biddle with the Council on Foreign Relations, Caroline Wadhams with the Center for American Progress. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. New revelations about the oil giant BP as the U.S. files a suit stemming from last summer's leak in the Gulf of Mexico. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Britain's Guardian newspaper today published new cables from WikiLeaks showing that BP had to evacuate 211 platform workers due to a gas leak in Azerbaijan 18 months before the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Just a sidelight to our story coming up next. Also should point out that Julian Assange finally got out on bail today. The U.S. filed suit today against the company, BP, charging violations of federal regulations before last summer's disastrous spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Jennifer DeLohi is a reporter who's been covering the Gulf oil spill for the Houston Chronicle and the Hearst newspapers. Jennifer, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Oh, thank you, Warren.
This is a big suit. Could cost BP an awful lot of money.
Not just BP. I mean, the lawsuit is actually filed against BP as well as eight other companies, including Transocean, which owned the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig. So there are a lot of companies that potentially could face some fines and fees as a result of this.
I've seen fines that could rise to tens of billions of dollars. Is that right?
It is. The Justice Department has made clear it's going to take a long time to assess the final price tag of the natural resource damages here and the cleanup costs. But just under the Clean Water Act alone, companies can be forced to pay as much as $4,300 per barrel if they're deemed grossly negligent. And the government has said that 4.9 million barrels of oil gushed into the Gulf. So if you just use that calculation, BP could be on the hook for $21 billion in Clean Water Act fines.
What other laws is it accused of violating?
Well, the Justice Department is also asking that the Federal District Court in New Orleans declare that all of these companies are legally liable under the Oil Pollution Act. That's a statute that deals with who's responsible and how payment is handled, basically, in the result of a spill or in the wake of a spill. And under this statute, BP could be forced to pay all of the government's costs for cleaning up the spilled crude. And then they also could be responsible for paying at least up to $75 million in economic and natural resource damages from the spill. That cap is completely waived, however, if there is a finding that was an instance of gross negligence or willful misconduct.
Aren't they also accused of failing to use the safest kind of drilling technology to take the necessary precautions to protect their own people in addition to the environment?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, the lawsuit basically lays out a number of different allegations that speak to basically preparation and monitoring of the Macondo well that blew out. There's an allegation that the companies failed to maintain continuous surveillance of the well, that they failed to use the right equipment that could really ensure the safety of their workforce as well as the environment.
You mentioned Transocean in addition to BP. What about Halliburton?
You know, Halliburton was one of several companies that have been that were involved with this well that are not named in the complaint. The Justice Department and Eric Holder made very clear yesterday that they are open to expanding this complaint in the future. There is a criminal investigation still underway, but for now, Halliburton, which did the cement work at this particular well, is not listed as a defendant.
How many other lawsuits have been filed, or is it possible to count them?
You know, frankly, I have a hard time keeping track. All of them have been, a good number of them have been consolidated in this New Orleans federal district court. They're being overseen by a single judge. And frankly, the Justice Department, their action in filing this suit was largely to get them in the game. The judge down there had said, if the Justice Department wants to send federal prosecutors to the depositions in these class action cases, then they need to file their own suit. And yesterday was the deadline for joining fishermen and vacationers and everyone else that is suing in relation to this bill.
Has the judge had to hire a big staff in order to deal with all of this?
My understanding is that there are challenges associated with litigation of this size. Even just reporting out basic information is being done in you know, new ways to try to reach a number of people who might not, you know, have access to the federal clearinghouse for court and legal information. So I understand, you know, resources are being stretched.
This looks like something that's going to take many years, if not a lifetime, to resolve.
I think that's a fear that many of the folks in the Gulf Coast have expressed. The Justice Department said yesterday that, you know, they think they're actually moving pretty quickly in their civil and criminal investigation, and the fact that they filed yesterday is an indication of that. But obviously there are folks along the Gulf Coast who would like this to be resolved swiftly and fear that, as was the case with the Exxon Valdez spill, it could take years, if not decades, to totally be resolved.
Well, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Jennifer DeLohey, reporter who's been covering the Gulf oil spill for the Houston Chronicle and also the Hearst newspapers. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Daryl Satzman, Christian Bordahl, Gary Scott, and Karen Redziner. Technical director Mike Newport. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point, and check us out on Facebook. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.